Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances, where personal finance and career advice feels excellent, Mortal Kombat style. And so we don't get sued. This is for entertainment purposes only.
And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances, on Facebook at Paychecks and Balances, or follow our individual accounts at the Marcus Garrett with one T on Twitter. One T on Twitter. Leave that in. Do not edit it out. And Rich is available at I am Rich Jones.
I am. Hashtag leave and it in.
Don't forget to join our email list by visiting paychecksandbalances.com/email. I can already tell y'all are in for a treat. And you'll receive our weekly newsletter covering actionable work and money tips and much more.
And as has been the case lately, today's episode is sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps the health conscious get lower rates on life insurance. So go to healthiq.com/paychecks to see if you qualify. Get on it. Go now.
Yes, sir. And we won't spend 5 to 7 minutes talking about our health plans this time around. So what are we going to get into, sir?
Yeah, so we're going to start with a this week in work, man. I had something happen at the day gig. Spoiler, I didn't get fired. That I haven't experienced before. And that's where the part of the company that I work in underwent a reorg, where there's kind of a subsidiary parent company. And then there's my company that was one of those, and it got folded into one of the other existing companies. And I'm being vague for reasons, though. If you go to my LinkedIn profile, you can very easily see where I work and so on. But since this is new, and though it is public, I'm not trying to change my spoiler that didn't happen to reality. So have you been through a reorg?
Man, the short answer is yes. And actually, I completely forgot about this. A reorg was one of the reasons I ended up getting my current job and started looking for work in the first place, because there was so much confusion on what would or would not happen. And wow, I actually forgot this took place, but there was a 6 month period in time where, and it turned out to be a rumor, they were saying that they were going to lay off everyone, and basically you had to reapply for your job to see if you still qualified under the new basically job description and roles. Crazy. And so there's just this like 6 month panic period where everyone's trying to figure out not only will they have a job in 6 months, but would it be the same job or would they have any job at all? So yes, there. And then so this one's recent, so I also must be vague, but we have been through several synergy practices to align with the vision of moving forward and continuous improvement. Yeah, I think that
nicely
works.
Done.
I think I could still have a job on Monday with that description.
Yeah, it's
I'm all on board. Yeah, I scream with joy with change and continuous improvement. All right, now there you go, sir.
Yeah, I mean, I did not scream with joy, even though I understood it was a good thing overall. And it's one of those things where when you hear the strategic reason behind it, it makes complete sense. But I'm like, how's that going to impact me? Like, I understand that's great for the company, but what about me? And I was nervous for a bit, man, because it was a few days before I knew what was really going to happen, what the plan was. And of course, when they do these things, when they say they have it figured out, they still don't have it all figured out. There's things that they're working through now that are still up in the air. But fortunately, I found out there isn't going to be too much of a change to my role, but this whole experience reminded me of the importance of staying ready. And so I had a few things that I've done or have been doing, things that maybe I need to do more of that other folks could benefit from. So I was going to run through that list real quick and hope that others can be prepared should they find themselves in the middle of a reorg that does actually impact them, or should they wake up one day and be like, yo, I hate this, I'm trying to get out, and to have themselves be in a position of power. So number one,
Let me ask you, maybe make one comment and then ask you one question. I think we'll tie into this of interest to the listeners as well. My comment is, and I read this somewhere, but you know, this idea of why, you know, I think they were saying that millennials are snowflakes, but I think this particular article was saying why, if that was true, we should be. Because it's the optics of, really, I guess empathy is the best way to describe it. Like, you don't have to go through a layoff or restructure or reorg yourself. But we all have friends, peers, colleagues. Like, there was a large entity out here. I won't say which one because I don't want to get sued. But I think anyone that lives here knows, like, one of the largest employers. And pretty much annually, every year, they'd lay off thousands. That was just their thing. They'd hire up like 10,000. And then, of course, every year they lay off a few of those like thousands of people. This was just a thing that they did. And you don't have to go through that layoff yourself to know that a bunch of other 20 or 30 year old individuals in the thousands like are going through that layoff. And I feel that people underestimate that stress that can have on you, even if you're not going through it. Like, that could happen to me, or that could be me, or I could be that friend on Facebook. Like, hey, please help. I just got laid off. Is anyone hiring? Or, you know, you see those posts out there. And I think folks underestimate the social network impact of people in your demographic also losing their jobs, even if it's not you personally. Then tying to that, my question was going to be, have you ever, if you want to talk about it, been formally laid off? Somehow, this might amaze the listeners. Somehow I have not. I've never been formally laid off. I've been almost fired twice, but never formally laid off. Both for good reasons. Both my fault.
Fortunately, I have not. But this is the first time, at least that I can remember. No. This is the second time, but probably the most dispensable that I've felt, where I was like, yo, there's so many people within this company. If my group gets folded in, and that's why I went through the whole, what's going to change? What does this mean for me? Yo, what's my role going to look like, dog? Had that conversation and all of that because I was legitimately concerned. And so I remember at a previous company, like, I knew that layoffs were coming and that I wasn't going to be impacted, but I also knew some other things that I probably still can't talk about, where I was kind of like, I should probably think about other opportunities. And then the role that I have now came into play and things ultimately worked out and I got out of there. And I remember, I think it was literally like a week or even like 2 days after I left my last job, they laid off like 25% of the company. And so I was kind of like, all right, got out just in time. It was almost like one of those scenes in like a movie where they're taking off in an airplane and like looking back and down and like everything's burning.
Yeah, I mean, and the reason I brought that up is it feels like, you know, people are confused by either this generation or whatever demographic you want. I'll just say people in mid-career are confused by the lack of loyalty or the trauma that folks have with seeing themselves in an organization with 5 or 10 years. That's really not even something I can imagine. I can see it more with this organization because that's probably somewhere between the median and the average that people stay with this. But before that, it's like you're describing. It's like, well, all I see around me is companies laying off people by the thousands, if not the tens of thousands. So why would I be practicing loyalty to this organization? It kind of reminds me of The Decision. So, you know, as unpopular as LeBron, aka The Decision was, that conversation was always strange to me because it's like, well, you know, and you can talk about how he marketed and everything like that, but why was everybody focused on that and no one focused on the entity doing it? So, looking at teams, so if these jobs were our teams, let's say these employers were the NBA, like they trade and lay us off all the time and no one makes a big deal about it. But the second I'm like, well, I'm going to make a better move for myself, people are burning, you know, the Marcus Garrett jersey in the front yard. And I'm like, yo, I got to look out for me too, not just the owners. So I always find that conversation fascinating. And one recently came up on the timeline and it was insane to me. We were talking about, it got retweeted again, you know which one, where it was talking about the average employer will see a 2-4% raise.
The average employee.
And maybe rage is actually the term because of that 2% raise or lack thereof. Yeah. And then new hires would see 10-20%. And most people, which is natural, are focused on, well, I don't want to switch jobs every 2 years. And I was like, I don't feel like that's the lesson here. You would knowingly stay loyal to a company that is underpaying you, but everyone's first go-to, because it just, to me, that's a mindset that your loyalty to the organization is more important to be fairly paid. And I feel like that's why wages stagnate, people settle, and people don't negotiate their salary, because there's this expectation that this organization, this entity, which is run by people, but it, you know, as the name implies, is a corporation, will do what's in your best interest, yet almost every figure, with, you know, some rare exceptions, I think those are the companies that are in those top 10 lists, they do not. They are focused on the bottom line. And you are just an expense on that line.
See, I agree, but I also think that the loyalty is one part of it. The other part, yo, the job searching is stressful, man. It's a stressful process. And a lot of people don't want to have to go through that process. And, you know, I started thinking about, oh, I got to update my resume again, this, that, and the third. I got to be proactive, et cetera. Even though I'm saying that as I'm being reactive to news that's vague and I don't know what it means yet. But the thought of having to circulate resumes, have conversations, interviews, and these are things that I do well and to some degree do already. But the fact that I would have to do those things, it stressed me out. And that was just within like a few days. I was like stressed out by the thought of it. So I think some of it is the loyalty, but then people also don't want to go through that whole process of having to apply for jobs, which I think ties back to kind of what I was saying at the beginning, where if you are proactive, it can be a little bit easier. The job search is still going to be stressful, but when opportunities come to you versus you have to go find them because something just happened, that's a completely different position to be in. And you feel like you have more of the power in that situation.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if I was clear there, and I'll let you get back to your point.
It was clear. It just made me think of that.
Yeah, I just think that it's two sides of the same coin. Loyalty, I think it's a lot more easy to be loyal to an organization that pays you well at a market rate, that gives you reasonable raises, in which you are happy and has a work-life balance, than an organization that does none of those things, and then they wonder why they can't keep employees for 2 years. So I see those are two related, not two independent thoughts. Like, well, I don't want to. Yeah, I think, yeah, the job search and looking and that can be a stressful process, but you shouldn't have to. But I feel like we exist in an environment where that's probably closer to the norm, unless these companies make a significant change, which best I could tell, they don't seem motivated to do so.
Nah, they won't. If it doesn't make dollars, they probably won't do it. I mean, for the most part, there are companies who start out doing the right thing. They build it into their values and culture and so on. And I am at one of those places where they inspire loyalty by providing all of the perks, benefits, and things that I'm grateful for. But at the same time, yeah, even though I could probably go find something else internally, like the thought of doing that, I'm like, yo, I'd rather not right now. I got goals in life. And I don't feel like resetting, because even sometimes when you take a step up or you take a new role, in some ways it is a reset. And I think about this because, you know, outside of work, we're doing the podcast. We both got entrepreneurial things that we're doing. And I felt like I was getting into a rhythm. And it always feels like these things come up when everything's in a good rhythm. I'm like, all right, boom, making progress, checking items off the list. Feel like I finally got things going where I'm starting to roll downhill. And then boom, this comes up. It's always something like this. Always.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So, yes. I don't know how to transition back, so I'm just going to jump right. I feel like I need a segue, but this isn't really working, so I'm just going to jump into it. So the first item that I had on the list here, updating your internal and external resume plus your LinkedIn profile at least quarterly. Now, we talked a lot about external resumes. And if you're in a larger company where there's opportunities for internal mobility, you probably should also have an internal resume that gets into more of the nitty gritty of what you've done in your current function. That's that people who are within the company are going to understand. And I know that where I'm at, people have internal resumes as well as external ones. And there's actually a format you're supposed to use for your internal resumes. And so I say quarterly because even if you're keeping a laundry list of your accomplishments and things that you've done throughout the year, which we've spoken about before, you can still forget stuff. Even if it's just adding a bullet point or tweaking a bullet point or tweaking a percentage, you want to make sure that both your internal and your external resume are current, so that if opportunity does come up, maybe you weren't looking, but you see something that looks like a great fit for you, you can apply for that right away and you don't have to spend a week trying to come up with a new resume. And then by the time you do go to apply, the position is closed, which absolutely sucks.
Yeah, the reason I don't have much insight here is I haven't maintained an internal and external resume. So I guess what led to that decision? Pros, cons, or benefits?
I think for me, it's that there's a standard kind of way that people talk about the projects that they've worked on. And with the internal resume, it's clear what the format is that people are looking to see and what type of things that they expect. And you also kind of have the advantage of knowing what the performance review structure looks like. And so there may be projects or things that maybe you can't talk about externally, but you can talk about in more detail in your internal resume because it's within the same company. That's probably the best example that comes to mind, where I might be working on something or be privy to some special initiative. And as far as my external resume, I have to be vague about it. But if I'm talking to someone who's in a different group or division, I can talk about it in more detail. And they're like, oh, okay, I know exactly what he's worked on, without having to kind of guess and figure out and go, should I call this person? Should I send them a message? Should I not? Because it's already concrete and right there. Does that make sense?
It does. And I've always said this as well, as far as internal applications go, and I'll open with the disclaimer, you know, ethically and follow the rules allowed within the structure or culture of your organization. But that being said, I think you're talking about internal promotions. But whenever I talk to an applicant who's applying internally for an open position, I look at that like an open book test again. So I would be looking into all the department details, the intranet, everything that is available to you as an internal candidate. I would use that as an advantage. So some people are like, well, that's unfair and I should open, you know, and it's a public forum, and some people externally don't have this information available to them. I'm like, hey, you know what? Sucks to be them. that's why they're trying to get in the organization. Now, I'm not saying you go to the hiring manager, corner them during their lunch break and slap the bagel out of their hand and ask them what questions are going to be, you know, on the interview, nothing like that. And that's why I said, you know, do it within the boundaries of what's allowed in your organization. However, I do think that's something you should take advantage of. Do you have any reason why you wouldn't recommend that for an internal candidate competing with external candidates?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, for our internal roles, you can contact the hiring manager directly and just have an informative and informal chat before you even start the process, just to understand if it's even a good potential fit. So yeah. I say go for it. There's no issues with asking questions.
I think some people, and that's good to hear, because I would have been given a lot of wrong advice. So I'm glad we were in line there. But yeah, I think some people are just uncomfortable with that. So I want to bring that up as a point that I think it's something that you should be comfortable with, and not only something you should be comfortable with, I think it's something you should actively be doing.
Yeah, I definitely encourage it. And I know people who do that now, where they're like, oh, I heard about this new role. I'm not sure if I want to apply for it yet, but I'm going to talk to the hiring manager, see what it is, see if it's a good mutual fit. Do I even like this manager? And then I'm going to decide if I can apply from there. So I definitely encourage people to have those internal conversations, talk to folks across divisions. And it's also another reason to just make sure that you're on top of your game and you think about your, as much as some people hate the term, your personal brand and how you interact with people, because you may be working with someone on a project who's then a manager for a role that you want to move into later on. And if they didn't have a good experience with you, even if it seemed like 2 years ago, their last reference point for you is going to be that you pissed them off, you didn't deliver something on time. So it's important to always be on top of your game, because you never know where that other person is going to end up.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah. And the other thing I would mention is also updating your LinkedIn profile on a quarterly basis as well. Again, that might be percentages, adding new bullet points, projects, responsibilities. Won't go too in depth about what the specific things are there. I think we've talked about that on a previous episode. And if not, when I look through the archive, we'll probably put together a future episode where we'll do a bit of a deeper dive on that. So essentially, keeping those critical documents and sites up to date. The other thing, which is related to what I was just talking about, is becoming and staying an above average performer. And the one thing that I see that really causes people to struggle here is not being clear about expectations. So you may suck and not know you suck. Or you could think that you're doing a great job and it turns out that you've been focusing on all the wrong things because you haven't been clear on expectations. Now, this is something that a good manager is supposed to do. They're supposed to help lay those expectations for you and make it very clear. But that's not always the case. And I have to admit, even myself, I realized when I first came into management, I kind of inherited how things were already being done. And I assumed that everything would carry over from the previous manager in terms of responsibilities and expectations and everything else. Not so much thinking about the fact that there are different things that I would like to see, and there's a different cadence that I work at, and there's a different way that I view quality that that the previous manager may not have. And so if you're coming into a new role or if you have a manager change, you want to make sure that you're clear on expectations. So when you're achieving things, it's very clear that you're achieving the right things. And also, if there is some type of situation where there's a restructuring or they're talking about layoffs or stuff like that, you want to make sure that it's very clear that you're a valuable contributor, a top performer, and someone that they would really regret to have to let go. Now, that may not stop it. There are plenty of times layoffs happen. Actually, I think in most layoffs, they end up laying off people who are top performers, but the The more you can do to keep yourself up there, the less likelihood, even though there still may be a chance of it, the less likelihood there is of you being one of the people that's going to be impacted. Now, there's no 100% way to prevent it, but you want to do what you can to, well, what's the corporate term? Mitigate risk, I think is what they say.
Hey, well done. You really nailed that. I was like, I have no idea where he's going, so I'm glad you saved that. Yeah, and another thing I would share along those lines is I think most people think it's a one-way street, and in theory, I guess it should be, but I've seen that not work out in practice or in reality. So if those conversations haven't been initiated by either your administrative manager or even the person you're reporting to on an assigned project, if that's not the same individual, I've initiated those conversations. Now, I have my reasons for doing that. It might just align with my personality, but it's tended to be helpful and beneficial to me because I think most people think no news is good news. And then they get their annual evaluation. They're like, yo, we never talked about this. I'm shocked and appalled. Whereas I'd rather have those conversations. I usually try to set up a one-on-one. If the manager hasn't already initiated it, I try to have it at least quarterly. So that's four check-in points for me to know if I'm on the right path or completely off the path within the year. Mm-hmm. But I've seen people just like, they wait and sit back and like, well, the manager is supposed to talk to me. They see the manager running around and they're busy and everything like that. And never takes place. And I'm like, well, no. And so, yeah, that's what all the books say. And that's what you're supposed to do. But if that conversation is not taking place, then I think it falls back on you as an employee to ensure that they do, because ultimately it's going to impact you, your bottom line and your check. Even if they never initiate those conversations.
Yeah, definitely, man. And I do want to underscore the point of being an above average performer. You know, I know it's easy to go to work, coast, do exactly what's expected of you. And that's cool. You know, it's cool to meet expectations. But I think the rule that I haven't talked about this rule in a while. I think the rule that I used to have was the top 20% rule. It was a 20% rule where my goal was to always be in the top 20% of performers in the group that I'm in. Now, if you're in a group of like three people, you know, I guess it's not that difficult unless the first two are really that far ahead of the game, or actually it would just be like one person. So pretty much if you're not the top person, you're automatically not in the 20%. I'm talking about when there's like 10, 15, 20 or a large number of people who you would say are in your peer group doing similar work. I encourage people to be in the top 20%. You know, that's going to have you above expectations. And I say top 20%. Some people are like, well, why not the top 5%? Why not the best? And if that's your goal, that's great. But what I found is what it takes sometimes to be that top person in your group, the level of commitment and dedication and everything else. There's some sacrifice that comes along with that. And I like to leave myself some margin, man. I'm not going to lie. It's like I know what I could do to be the absolute number one person, but I'm probably not going to have a life if I do that. I'm probably not going to be able to participate in some of the activities that I participate in if I'm spending all my time pouring everything and every hour into the day job. So I'm like, yo, I know how to be better than average. In fact, I know how to be great. It doesn't take me that much to be great, and I am okay with that. Now, there are some people who might dispute that. How do you feel about that, man?
I think it's fine, but I think more importantly, it's, you know, that would be a sort of, instead of personal finance, I'd say that'd be your personal career. Like, I think it's a personal choice. To extend the thought that I had earlier, another recommendation I made, because it depends on your structure, is to have like a cadence as well. So if you so it might be different at different organizations. It might be VP or director or deputy or whatever the equivalent is in your management chain. I try to have a conversation at least once a year with someone pretty high up in that chain. Now, I was fortunate before this restructure that I actually spoke to the highest person in my particular division, but I'm now in a different part of the organization. So that was a lot easier for me. So basically, I'm just initiating a conversation with my manager. But that being said, I recommend it to people. So to the cadence might be something like the top person, you meet with them, they're going to be pretty busy. So get on their calendar maybe once a year. And that might be all you need, because they're probably going to be talking about strategy, big picture vision. Here's what we want to happen in the organization. And then either someone one or two levels below them meet with that person quarterly and just talk about, OK, here's the big picture that I understand for the organization. Now, mind you, I'm in mid-career, so I'm like at a manager level. But I still think this is something I could have done earlier in my career and actually actually I was fortunate to have done because I had a good relationship by coincidence with my director. Mm. And then your administrative manager, if they are available or possible or it's amenable to your job, I would try to meet with that person monthly. So your immediate person that you report to, having a monthly conversation, maybe their boss. Or what I've also recommended, if they don't have a boss, so, because sometimes the level just goes manager, director, CEO, whatever your equivalent is. Sometimes I've recommended to folks to find someone in the organization that can be your mentor or your network person that is either equivalent to your administrative manager or not. Because I think people, like you're saying, they restrict themselves to this is the person I report to, so therefore they're the only person I can talk to. I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. Mm. If you're either not getting what you need from that relationship, or, let's just be positive. Let's say you want to get more well-rounded career. I also think it's good to have some insight from your administrative manager, because that's the person you that's going to be doing your annual evaluation. But I might want some objective advice just from another manager, not to go around and gossip and talk about what me and my manager are doing. But maybe I just want somebody else to say, yes, I agree with that. Or have you thought about, or have you considered, who has no dog in the fight? They're not writing up my plan. They're not managing the project, but they are a project manager, or they do write plans. So they can take just an abstract look at the conversation or issue that you're dealing with and just offer advice and insight. And I'll get this in the show notes as well, is, an article. I've seen a lot more articles now that recommend like a board of mentors or a network committee versus you just have this one mentor. Now, one is better than zero, and I do think you should have something, but I've seen more and more seem to be moving towards you should have like a panel of insights, and those individuals might have different roles in your career or personal life. Maybe one is guiding you on your career path, but maybe another is guiding you on getting your graduate degree and how you can use that to further your career. And maybe another has insights on certifications and how they use that. It's basically just getting multiple perspectives on making you a more well-rounded individual or employee.
Yeah. And also, I think it's good to be visible to somebody outside of your direct manager. Now, more times than not, you're going to work with people across functions. And yes, your manager should be your biggest cheerleader and make sure that everyone who's above them knows that you're doing a good job or knows how you think and knows that you're pleasant to work with. But sometimes it's good to interact with those people directly yourself and let them experience it versus relying on your manager to tell them.
Yeah. And I also think, and it's funny to me that people don't, and maybe you experience this, people don't have this insight until they're in management. So it's one of those things that you talk about, but it's hard to recognize until they're actually a manager. And I say that I don't know, or people assume that the way they want to be managed is the way everyone wants to be managed. That is patently false. Indeed. Because I can also tell you, as a manager, the way I want to manage is not universally applicable to the people that I manage. And I say that because there may be somebody who, if I went to them and said, hey, I want to meet with you each month just to have, general conversation about it, they'd be like, I don't, if I never saw you for the rest of the year, like, only talk to me when something's going wrong. And then there are other people like a month, like I want to talk to you every morning. I'm like, so, there's a balance in there where I think folks assume that you get promoted to manager and suddenly you are just the greatest all-knowing manager in the world.
Nope.
Most people, several studies have shown, but I don't even need a study to, most people get into management because most people don't set out to become managers. Most people get into management for salary increases. It is a natural progression of their career, or they get promoted or moved, sometimes forced, and a manager, I was actually joking with somebody. Oh, okay. I got the new iPhone this week. I was like, who is this somebody? I was talking to a young guy who works at AT&T, which I could now talk about. AT&T, which I worked at briefly part-time, was the best training program. Now, mind you, it's very tailored. It's a $1 billion organization. They sell phones. But that was the best
You really training. Simplified it there, man.
Yeah.
They just move units.
Yo, that was the best training I've had in my entire career. As it go, and any job that I've ever done, and I've done a lot. I've talked about all the things I've done. And specific, focused, smart goals delivered. Like it seemed like they had clearly every best practice you're supposed to do in training. They did, and I was selling phones part time. And I say all that because I've worked for organizations that are, roughly as big or make as much gross as AT&T, or on the same scale. But their training program is, here's your laptop.
Trash.
see you in 12 months. So everything I learn, do, succeed, or fail is on the job training. That's what they call it. On the job training is code for good luck. You know what I'm saying? You just show up, go to that meeting, and they just expect you to learn all the time. And I've been trying to tell people that experience is more the rule than the exception of tailored, specific, objective training. Like, here's policies and procedures. And even in organizations where I've worked that are better at that, no one follows them. So they have this book, looks like an encyclopedia set of standard operating procedures. And I'm like, so, you know, how do you set this up? And they're like, let me pull out the manual. You know, dust flies off of it. They flip to some page they've never used. That they're like, they make a thumbprint on that page for the first time. This page is pristine because no one has ever opened this standard operating procedure that I assume we paid somebody else thousands of dollars to write and put together for us.
Yep.
So this idea, I guess I'm trying to say it nicely, but I think most people will see over their career, and it's fine. You know, obviously, you know, it works because, you know, the world is turning. But most people have this masquerade of what work is. And then you go to work and you find out what work actually is. Just like how the sausage is made, I guess, you know, going back to the old school saying, because I'm old school now. Because I remember when I first came out of school, it was jarring to me. Yeah. And for a long time, it was like cognitive dissonance. Like, I could not accept, like, I'm like, this isn't work. This isn't what they talked about in school. This isn't what I read in the books. This is like a movie.
Yo, it literally, I said before that when I came out of school, I was selling first aid kits. And I really felt like Will Smith in The Pursuit of Happiness. Like, there's this image of him like out there in the streets looking disheveled and anxious with like that gigantic machine in his hand. That was like me in a suit with a first aid kit. And I was like, this is not what I thought corporate America was going to be. I mean, even though I accepted that job, of course, expecting other things because they did a great job selling the position. And I was like, this isn't what I imagined. And there were mad days where I would just like bang the first aid kit against my knee and be mad at myself, be down on the ground, clutching my knee like Peter Griffin and Family Guy. Like, yo, this is not the dream as I imagined it. So I feel you on that.
Yeah, my first job was data entry. I did that for the same thing. First job I got offers, the one I bring up all the time. I was making $19,000. I had benefits. So, you know, I try to be, you know, grateful for what I did have. But I remember the most jarring, I guess, realization between college and me, which is almost insane to say this now because of how quickly time goes. But when I got out of school, and technically school is just school is like Vegas. It's like New York. It never sleeps. It's just this 24-hour cycle. And I remember I'd go to work for 8 hours and I was like, what do people do with the rest of their lives? Yep. Because I'm so used to operating on this 24-hour schedule where you know, first of all, I'd wake up at like 12. I go to class, or if I, just based on that, if I went to class that day, I'd go to class, you know, first of all, you set your own schedule, which in itself was insane to me. So, you know, I had all kinds of weird things. I'd go to class from like 8 to 10, take a nap from like 10 to 2, go to this afternoon class or night class, or whatever the case may be, because I was insane. I wasn't strategic enough to take all my classes in the morning. Plus, I was lazy. Yeah, then I'm in the library, or I'm planning, or I'm partying, I'm doing whatever. But it's just this 24-hour period. Now, I remember when I started going to work and working 8 hours a day, I'd get off work. I'm like, What do you do? This is pre Netflix.
What did I do?
Pre everything that can occupy your time now. And that was crazy to me. And I thought it was crazy. People were like, oh, there's never enough time in the day. I'm like, there's too much time. I don't even know what to do with this remaining 16 hours of this day.
Not anymore.
Yeah. That is an illusion that no longer exists. But I mean, that's what I'm talking about. And these are the things I think you learn over your career. But I think a lot of people, to the degree that I can encourage or offer advice, if you are looking for more, stop. Accept it for what it is and then put a plan together for how you're going to change or have. Because I think what people underestimate is how much control they have over these changes, their career, their life, because they're waiting for something else to be defined. And I think that's because of how we're taught. It's really the learning. Like from first through 12, you're taught how to do things. There's a plan for you. And then if you go on to college or military or whatever, there's another plan for you. Mm-hmm. And that lasts for 4 years with a much longer scale, unless you go on to graduate or to become a lawyer or JD or whatever, you know, the case may be. There's no plan. You just go to work. It's almost insane. They give you this plan your life for, you know, for 18 to 24 years, and then they just turn you loose on the earth. Good luck. It is on the life training.
you make people sound like Walking Dead characters, man.
No, I would say, I mean, it's not a bad thing. It's just, is the release of that structure. And I think you spend, I would definitely say the early part of your career looking for that structure again. And it never returns in that format.
No.
Like, my structure is now defined by me. Now, yes. Do I need to show up for 40 hours within the time that I've stated for them? And, you know, if I'm working from home or whatever the case may be, yes. But beyond that, my boss doesn't even care what I'm doing. I would argue he doesn't know what I'm doing. I'm sure he assumes I'm doing what those standard operating procedures that we're supposed to do that no one reads. But from day to day, he's not walking over, like, there's no grade.
Yeah.
There's no test. He's not, you know, coming over each quarter like a pop quiz, Marcus. It's like, I am just, I guess, a professional adult. I'm just supposed to act professionally and follow the rules and do what is expected of me. And like you said, go above and beyond. But I think that is such a change for people. They almost reject it. It's like rejecting the Matrix.
Yeah, everything always comes back to the Matrix one way or another. I feel like I always have to make a reference to the movie. It always ties to something that's happening in life.
See, now I'm scared. Yes, I think it is relevant. But as I've talked about, now I'm at that point where my cultural relevance is losing its relevance. So I wonder how long the Matrix will hold relevance. It's a good movie. It's a classic. I don't know if it's like a classic. It is a good movie. And I say that because I was reading what would be today for this podcast and whenever it drops, but I was reading something that it was simple math, but it blew my mind. It was talking about why these 18-year-olds are having so much influence now. And they said Twitter has been around for 2/3 of their life.
That made me feel really old.
Bruh, that blew my mind.
I feel like, I feel like a pioneer. That's what feel like.
2/3 of your life. Just think about it. I mean, you could say that reasonably about social media, but the relevance and the fluidity and the speed in which Twitter operates. Like, you know, you have a thought, you drop it now. And it put to every tweet that everyone sends technically could potentially go viral. And that's been 2/3 of your life. So 2/3 of your life is operating at the speed of Twitter. It's damn near operating at the speed of light. So, of course, they would be frustrated, tired when everything else is instantaneous, but life.
That makes sense.
Yeah, man.
That makes sense, given that they say this generation is the I want it now generation. I mean, that's generation Y and Z or whatever it is now.
And that article that keeps going viral and likely will again sometime soon, talking about why people, external hires were making basically about twice the amount when they switch jobs, is because not only companies have not, they reasonably now anyway, in most entities, and I would say even organizations, can't. Like, there is no adaptability that allows for a company to move that quickly.
Yeah,
because like they were saying, most of your pay bumps are based on the salary they brought you in. So it inherently would be a slower trend than external hires. And also they're competing with the market for external hires. And so they were saying it's not that, well, some don't, but it's not that organizations don't want to change. They are literally constrained by time. Everything is moving around these entities faster than the entities are able to adapt.
And shareholders, I'd say. For some of the companies, which always reign supreme. Today's episode is sponsored by HealthIQ, a life insurance company that helps you save money on your life insurance for living a health-conscious lifestyle. Now, I don't know about you, but for me, it's pretty dope that I could save money on life insurance simply by doing things I'm already doing. Meaning I could catch a quality rate for hitting the gym consistently, beast mode. Eating these salads every day, beast mode. And not smoking Black and Milds, lung air release mode? to see if you qualify for the most exclusive rate, which can be up to 33% savings. I speak Guapanese. Get your free quote today at healthiq.com/paychecks. Again, that's healthiq.com/paychecks. See if you save money. And now back to the show. So jumping back, because we went down a productive rabbit hole there, man. I was like, wait, what are we supposed to be talking about again? next item that I had in here, and we've touched on this a few ways already, but the ABC, always be connecting. So as Jeannie said on a PB81, get out there and meet people. She talked about how she spent a whole year really just networking and how that helped her get into the roles that she wanted to get into. And this is also how people get access to the hidden job market, man. I've talked about that a while ago, but these are those positions where they're never posted. Someone knows that a friend is hiring, a friend is a manager somewhere, or somebody says, hey, I want to add someone to the team. Do you know anybody? And before that position even hits the job board, there are people who are getting their resume submitted because they came to mind. Or even if there's recruiters who are out there proactively on LinkedIn looking for people, building pipeline for a role. Maybe the job description isn't finalized yet, but they want to have people ready to go. And so they're going to be running searches, and you're going to want to make sure that you're in their network. Now, it's impossible to be in everyone's network, but if you're not one who feels like you can get out there on a regular cadence and go to events and meet people, you could start with this internet thing that we were just talking about, a professional social media platform that gives you access to a ton of people. And all you have to do is send them a custom message, ask to join their network. That is a simple way to expand your circle of people and find out about opportunities that you may not see elsewhere. I mean, there are times where I've posted, said, hey, I'm looking for a new technical recruiter, looking for a marketing manager, looking for an intern. And there are people in my network who are like, yo, I know someone for this, or they may be interested themselves, or I've had an exchange with them in a group, or they've liked the post or something like that. And I'm like, oh yeah, I know this person. And so they become someone that I keep in mind. And so one of the best ways to remain proactive is to constantly be connecting with new people. And going back to a previous point, I just realized this. I was like, man, I was selling first aid kits. There's probably someone out there who's like, yo, I sell first aid kits. What's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with selling first aid kits. I just want to make that clear. I'm just saying it banged my knee, which caused me pain and suffering, which then made me evaluate life.
Hey, I told you it all comes full circle. Apparently, the knife industry is still alive and well because they got their clutches into my nephew. I think it was Thanksgiving dinner. He's like, yeah, I started selling knives door to door. I'm like, that mid-level marketing scheme is still out there. So, you know what? It is what it is. But I also feel like, I think my father said this to me once. You have to, well, you don't have to, but I think it was helpful for me to try all of those get-rich-quick schemes, because they have made me a more well-rounded, practical individual today. So, oh, yeah. You know what? If you're out there selling, you know, first aid kits, knives, Bitcoin, you know, whatever your get-rich-quick scheme is, I'm not going to knock your hustle. Again, I think it ties back to the plan. And I'd say to at least have a backup plan. Usually, I don't ask people what their first plan is, assuming they have one. I'm more interested in what's plan B. So yeah. If the Bitcoin doesn't work out, if the first aid kit doesn't work out, if you can't clear selling knives door to door, what else? What next? What do you fall back on? And I feel like most people are just one stream and they haven't even asked themselves that. They're like, this is it. I'm all eggs in this basket. Like this is my hustle.
Yeah. Yeah. And even tying that to the 20% rule, I think part of the reason that I can say, you know, I want to be an above average performer, but I don't need to be the absolute best in my group, is because I also know where I don't want to go. Like, I don't want to be a director. I don't want to be a VP of recruiting. Maybe those things somehow happen anyway, but I have plans to not be in the 9-to-5 long enough for that to be like a step in my career. And I can say that open and honestly, like, I don't. So the things that are necessary to get there are sacrifices that I would have to make if that were the choice or the path that I wanted to take. I already know that that's not the path I want to take. I'm happy to be a manager as I am now, you know, maybe manage a larger team, but, you know, climbing up to VP level and being the person responsible for like tens of thousands of people, that ain't me, dog. Nah.
Yeah, I've by coincidence either worked with or have been a part of a lot of succession planning. So for those of you not familiar with what succession planning is, it's basically preparing the next crop or generation or up and coming managers or whatever the case may be. It's so you're prepared when the institutional knowledge. Someone said this to me yesterday. I was almost offended again for the second time. They're like, Marcus has a lot of institutional knowledge. I'm like, I've been here 2 years, but I realized.
Made you sound like a relic.
Yeah, exactly. I realized that's because so many people are new. So it actually was accurate. But I'm seeing consistently, and I had someone say this to my face. I didn't even really know how to take. They're like, I don't want your job. Like, I don't want to run to as many meetings as you do and work as hard and do the things that you have to do. Like, that is not even something. And they're working the same jobs as me. Mind you, we are both in the same building. They're like, I don't, whatever my career path is, it's not going to be that. And I don't know if that's, taking my ego out of it. I don't know if that's a reflection of age or the luxury of being in your early 20s where you'd be like, I'm never going to be a manager. And I'm like,
You know what, man? That just terrified me because I remember before when I was like, yo, man, I see the way my manager scrambles around and I don't want that job. And now I'm that manager. And so now I'm sitting here and I'm like, I don't want to be a director or VP, man. That's not the life I want. And I'm like, it's going to happen anyway.
Well, I mean, you think about it. It is the natural path, if for no other reason, because you have the years of experience. My manager, or now mentor, former manager, gave me some insight that was both revealing and terrifying. But this is, I think, the benefit that comes with age. So he's, about 10, 15 years my senior. But he said, and I was looking at a role equivalent to his prior one, and he's taken a step up since then. He said, be careful with that because as far as career paths go, it is only people at least expect you to make horizontal or up. Yeah. So in this example, if you become a director, you can never be a manager again. People will see that as a step down, or they'll be hesitant to bring you in as a manager because they'll think, first of all, likely be a pay decrease. And most people don't think like that. They're like, oh, I want to make it to the mountaintop. And I saw a quote recently from Nelson Mandela. I thought it was inspirational. I shared it with a few people. They thought it was depressing. And it said, when you reach the top of a hill, in his case, or I'd say mountain in this scenario, you realize there are more mountains to climb.
Yeah.
I thought that was inspirational. I shared that with some people and they're like, so I'll just be climbing? Yeah. To me, I was like, well, that means there's more challenges, there's more opportunities. And they were like, I'm never done. This race never ends. I'm like, well, I guess that's also one way to look at it.
Nah, man. Nah. So there's one caveat for where it's okay to go from being a director to a manager again. And that's when you work at a really small company where you can get a super senior title just because there's just not that many people there. And so I have seen people go from a director at a small company to maybe being a senior manager at a much larger and established company. That's like the only situation I've seen where that works and people don't question it. If you're within the same company and you take a step down, you are hopefully making a transition into a new field. But in other cases, that's really the only one where I've seen that be socially acceptable or professionally acceptable. One of the two.
Yeah. And I agree. And I'd say the same with maybe startups, or you go into your, obviously if you're an entrepreneur, you go into your own organization. I'm going to go ahead and run this back because I don't feel like I should be butchering Nelson Mandela quotes, even though I think I was pretty close. The exact quote is
someone's
going to write in like, what the? After climbing a great hill, one only finds that there are many more hills to climb. I feel like I was close, but I was like, you know what? That's probably not somebody I should be misquoting.
Especially during Black History Month.
Ah, excellent point. I think that's a nice save there. But I agree with you. And I think, wrapping my, if I could put a bow on this, wrapping my head around it, what's helped me now, again, this goes back to the management style, my personal style. Like, it actually helps me to have that kind of context. I find it more comforting when I know others are going through it. More importantly, others have gone through it and have either accomplished it, beat it, or made it out on the other side. That's actually helpful for me. But as I just said, some people don't view it that way. They're like, man, that's depressing. I see it as inspirational. But I would say what it did was put a different framework, and that's why it reshaped my thinking on, man, do I really want to retire, or do I want to find something similarly sustainable that I either do myself or is run by me or I have greater control over, because ultimately maybe that's what I'm looking for. And I said this to somebody recently, and, you know, because I think we're all around that age. So we're having these mid-level, mid-career / midlife crises, you know what, inspirational conversations, synergy conversations. And I said to someone, and, you know, after they went through what they were going through at their work, and it was eerily similar to what I was going through. So maybe what we're going through is the mid-career period, regardless of organization. But tying it back to what I said about trying to escape the matrix, all these things that we seem to be talking about, not limited to the shows, it was this conversation I was having with this friend. Maybe what we're fighting against is work. So we keep thinking there's more, there's something different. We're just not in the right industry. Both of me and this individual have been in multiple industries. We've had multiple jobs. We've done pretty much night and day things. And I just kind of took a step back from it because we've had multiple conversations. It sounds like maybe this is work. And we keep trying to redefine it and think it's something else. And this can't, or maybe is. And it, maybe we just need to accept that it is. It is what it is. And we keep trying to solve a different formula rather than accepting the more simpler formula is 1 + 1 = 2.
Yeah.
We're like, nah, it's got to be 3. It's got to be 3. Hold on. Let me erase it again. I must have not carried the 1 correctly. And it's like, maybe what we're describing is work. Thus, that's why so many people back in the day went through midlife crises. And I've had I don't think it's my own theory, but my theory would be that because everything is more accelerated and we have so much more access to information that other people had to get into that career to experience. Like if I want to know about a career, I just hop on Google and figure it out. I feel like that timetable has been moved up. I just feel like we're coming to that realization at an earlier age.
Yeah.
It's not good or bad. Well, not to me. As I said, that just lets me know that someone else went through it. They just happened to go through it in their 40s at 45. And I'm thinking like that at, you know, 30, 35. Now, I look at that as a positive because I feel like I can adjust and I have a longer period to do so. They adjusted, you know, they being, you know, our parents and a lot of individuals that we work with are in management. So it clearly can be done. But what does that look like for me or this generation? I find that to be hopeful.
Look at you instilling hope in the people as we close out Black History Month strong.
Yes, sir.
That's what's up, man. So recapping on the importance of staying ready. First point, updating your resume and LinkedIn profile on a quarterly basis, the specifics of the how and what in terms of updating. We'll talk about that in a future episode if we haven't revisited already. Well, even if we have visited before, we should probably revisit it again because there's a lot of new people who are following along today that weren't there way back when. Also, the importance of becoming and staying an above average performer, including being clear on expectations with your manager when you come in, when you have a manager change, making sure that you know what a good job looks like and that you are going above and beyond, but not at the point that you're killing yourself out there. And then always be connecting, networking. We've talked about it a lot. We're going to continue to keep talking about it. Even when you go out for drinks and you bump into someone, I think about the random people that I've met just out at social functions, parties, sporting events. Yo, fam, we hired someone that I met after a professional wrestling event who somehow recognized my LinkedIn profile, my face, which is a skill that within thousands of people, they recognized me. We had a conversation. And it didn't end up happening right away. It was a number of months that went by. But when the right opportunity came up, I thought about that person. And just to be very clear, when they interviewed, I made sure that they interviewed with other people and not like just with me and like took my word for it. So it wasn't just like, that person only got hired because they're a wrestling fan. Like, nah, they went through a full process. But had I not met that person and had a conversation with them, a pleasant conversation with them and learned a little bit about them, when I got that email later on, like following up, like I would have been like, yo, who's this? And potentially not had the time because I get a lot of messages like that on a daily and weekly basis as is. So you never know. You never know. It's just important to get out there. Even if it's going to something once a month, just putting yourself out there in a environment where you can run into new people. Even if you're with people that you already know, they're probably going to have friends or contacts or other folks that you're going to be able to meet. And you never know when that might benefit you or when you may be able to benefit them because it is very much a two-way street.
Yeah, I agree. And for folks who might not have that network or know where to go, I flash back to Jeannie's advice on episode 81, where she said she joined organizations. I mean, I'm amazed by how many organizations and conferences. I think I read somewhere that they said there's like 8,000 conferences going on each day. I know it's was in thousands because it was shocking.
8K sounds.
Yeah, crazy, I mean, like across the country. But yeah. I mean, and think about all the things there could be a conference for. I remember it was a really large number. I'm like, huh. And I was like, wow, that's really big. But then I was like, just think about all the things going on in the world. So if you don't have that natural progression or opportunity or access, go out there and find it. And a lot of those memberships aren't that much. I mean, a lot of us are, I'll say, liberally donating to our gym memberships.
Yeah.
I don't know how often we're using it, but it can clearly be done. So I don't want to hear the excuse of I can't find it. It can be done if it's a priority to you.
Yeah, definitely, man. So if you enjoyed today's episode or found it useful, be sure to share and hit us with those 5 stars in Apple Podcasts. As we always say, the more people we reach, the more people we help. And we have a 5-star review this week, man. I think I can take this one for you, unless you want to jump to it.
You good?
All right, cool. So this week's 5-star review comes from Marty King, and the headline, Brothers Making Moves. And it reads, I found this podcast by accident, but I loved it ever since I heard the first 2 episodes. They have real in-depth discussions on topics that African Americans and other Black people may have in their lives with humor and honesty. While I listened to several podcasts, this quickly became my favorite. Salute to the team and thanks for the advice. You know what? This feels like a fitting one to close out Black History Month on, man. I like that.
Appreciate that, Martin.
Also, related to this, we were featured this month by NerdWallet. So they did a list of, I believe it was 12 African-American financial gurus to follow, even though we don't call ourselves gurus. So we did catch a mention there this year, which is the second year that we've been mentioned. So shout out to NerdWallet for that. And all of the feedback that we've been getting over the past month from folks who've been listening to the show and for those that continue to submit reviews, whether we read them on air or not.
Yes, sir.
So, yeah, again, thanks to everyone for listening. Until next time, next month, be safe. We out. Peace.